Now, Dr. Joan Kenley, psychologist and author of Whose Body Is It Anyway, brings you Conversation Radio on Green 960 KKGN every Saturday at 5 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Joan Kenley, welcoming you to The Joan Kenley Show, bringing you Conversation Radio, where talking really matters. Today, our topic is election fever, and the Democrats in our country are fired up about the presidential election like nothing in recent history. The media and pundits are having a feast about what they choose to report and how they frame the message, which we may not always like. Emotions surge in every direction. Comparisons become odious. So how do we sort this all out? Well, we have the perfect guests to inform us and engage us in a lively conversation. Kate Forrest and Barry Kendall from the Commonweal Institute, which has a mission to guide and sustain the modern progressive movement through research and advocacy in order to advance common sense policies and catalyze progressive social change in America. Really, really good thing to do. And Commonweal is also committed to advancing core principles that embody the essential values of moderate and progressive individuals and organizations. Dr. Catherine Forrest is the president and co-founder of the Commonweal Institute, an action-oriented advocacy progressive think tank based in the San Francisco Bay Area. She specializes in idea marketing and political strategy and is the creator of the Institute's popular seminar, Talking Politics with People Unlike Ourselves, and we're going to talk about that a lot in just a few minutes. She's a physician by training, and Dr. Forrest has medical and public health degrees from Harvard University. Barry Kendall, the executive director of the Commonweal Institute, is an expert in the use of drama and narrative to bring people to a new understanding of themselves and the world. Through Commonweal, he applies these skills to build support for the kinds of values and ideas that will create a better society. Mr. Kendall has a master's degree in religion from Yale and a PhD in drama from Stanford. So welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
It's nice to be here.
And Kate, with your background in medicine and public health, I'd love for you to tell us about your professional journey over the years and what brought you to your decision to co-found the Commonweal Institute.
I started my career getting an MD from Harvard and then getting a master's in public health. And I'll tell you, public health was very exciting because I felt like I was really dealing with what was going on at the level of the system. Mm-hmm. What are the things in society that are getting in the way of people being able to be healthy, and how in aggregate can we make a healthier population?
And we need those answers today.
We still do. It's still always a pressing question. I went from there to Yale. I was on the faculty in the School of Medicine there for several years. And while I was there, I started the Office for Women in Medicine. So I'm one of the early feminist types.
Yes, good.
And following that, moved out to California with my family and was medical director at Planned Parenthood in San Jose.
A program we know and love and have worked with, my husband and I. So we have great admiration for everything they do.
While I was at Planned Parenthood, I started doing a clinical trial program for testing new kinds of contraception and eventually went into consulting, working with companies that were developing new contraceptive products. My consulting practice ended up being in the area of drug safety. So I was dealing with, again, public health types of issues. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you make safer products? It was after the 2000 election that Leonard Sal, who was my late husband, and I took a look at what was going on in Washington, where all of a sudden we had the George W. Bush administration coming in with, it seemed like, a whole bunch of people who had some pretty drastic ways that they wanted to change how the country was operating. And the Democrats in Congress were just sort of sitting there and wanting to be bipartisan.
Yeah.
And we said, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. I mean, where is their spine?
Mm-hmm.
And so just, you know, as ordinary folks, we said, maybe we can go to D.C. and get some of the nonprofits to bring some pressure on the Democrats, really.
Which they needed.
Which we thought they needed. We went there. We got to meet with top people at organizations like NARAL and many of the foundations there. And we're quickly disabused of the idea that the major liberal nonprofits were going to work together. They were in a position where the union people didn't want to work with the women's rights people because they didn't want to go anywhere near topics of abortion. And then the environmentalists didn't want to work with labor. And all these
sorts
of divisions.
It sounds like a quagmire.
Yeah,
and it still is.
It really was. And in the process, we learned, though, about how the conservative movement had organized themselves and started operating a long time ago, since the early 1970s, not only to influence formal public policy in the political arena, but really to change the way the public thought about issues and values that underlie what is going on in the political arena. And so we tried, on some of these multiple trips to D.C., we tried to persuade the smaller think tanks on the left to do the same kind of thing. Wouldn't you like to do it? We'll just help you.
Mm-hmm.
And kept running into roadblocks there too. Oh, it's too big. It's too ambitious. It's not our mission. And finally, on plane trip back to California, we said, well, darn it, if nobody else is going to do it, somebody has to try. I guess it's up to us.
And so we are the people we've been waiting for.
We are the people we've been waiting for, right. And so we came back to California and we found a name for Commonweal Institute. We incorporated in D.C. in the fall of 2001 and have been in operation ever since.
And of course, we'll refer everybody to your wonderful website, which talks about how deeply layered this program is in your institute and how many ways you get people involved. But that's quite a journey, and I love hearing your story because it is inspiring to see what couldn't work and then what had to work from your own inspiration to say, this is it. This is it.
What I love about the story is that two ordinary citizens from way outside the Beltway decided they wanted to try to make a difference.
Exactly.
That's what I just find incredibly inspiring about this story about two people who loved each other and loved this country.
Yes,
and
yes.
Decided they wanted to do something to try to move it back in a positive direction. And fortunately, with Kate's background in the world of public health and with Leonard's background in the world of civil engineering, they had gained some insights in business, in marketing,
sure.
And in training that enabled them to see what needed to be done in a way that somehow the folks who were in Washington at that time couldn't see. Now, fortunately, now a lot more people do see the need for a progressive movement that
Indeed.
Operates independently of what's happening inside the political structures in Washington.
And so tell us about your story. What sort of were the breadcrumbs going forward from your work in religion, theater, and then activism?
Sure, sure. Well, my first love was the arts. I grew up in Arkansas, and my exposure to music and theater was my first real way of learning about the broader world.
Mm-hmm.
And performing became a real passion for me. And so I went off to college, and I continued to pursue a career in the arts. And then after college, I stayed in the arts community in Atlanta, and was for three seasons the managing director of a wonderful theater called Seven Stages. And if you're ever in Atlanta,
we'll have to look it up.
Look it up. It's in a great little neighborhood called Little Five Points, funky bohemian feel. And Seven Stages did wonderful work that was dedicated to social change. And so we would do these shows. And a big part of what we would do is we would have post-show discussions afterwards where we would talk about with the audience what they had seen and the memories that it evoked for them, the experience of watching the play. And I still remember really vividly realizing how important the arts and our culture can be as a vehicle for changing people's outlooks on the world. We did a play once called Dream Boy. It was a stage adaptation of a novel by our playwright in residence at the time, a man named Jim Grimsley. Wonderful story about a young boy coming of age and growing up gay in the South. It opened up people's minds and helped them see a new way of looking at the world. And that's how cultures change.
Culture changes through conversation. Culture changes through the arts, of course. And this is sometimes in theater, because I was in theater many years, you can say things on the stage that people aren't ready to have a conversation about, but it stimulates the possibility that the conversation is possible.
That's right. That's exactly right. And the same thing can happen educational institutions, right, where I've spent a lot of time. And the same thing can happen in religious institutions. These are the epicenters of our culture, and that's where people form their views of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what I spent a lot of time studying through my degrees in religion and in drama. And that is the kind of expertise that I now bring to Commonweal Institute, which is, if you looking back, catalyzing progressive social change, we're really talking about changing the culture.
Oh, we are indeed. And particularly this year, in the election fever we're all feeling, it becomes more important than ever that people know about Commonweal and what they're offering and how they can relate to some of the programs that you have. And frankly, we're champing at the bit here to talk about the closer than close contest for the Democrats and who will win the White House in 08. We don't know, but everybody's got an opinion about it and talking about it. So Kate Berry and I have a lot to say about this historic primary season with the first woman and the first African American vying for the presidency. 27 million votes have been cast since the primaries began, and the ballots are split almost down the middle. Who could have ever predicted this? It's just amazing. So do keep listening, and we'll keep talking about election fever.
You found it, and it's different. The Joan Kenley Show, right here on Green 960 AM, KKGN. What's not to love about The Joan Kenley Show, where talking truly matters, here on 960 KKGN.
I'm Joan Kenley, and you're listening to The Joan Kenley Show. We're talking today with our special guests, Barry Kendall and Kate Forrest of Commonweal Institute. The hot political election fever that we're talking about today is in the air everywhere. And what's going to put Obama or Clinton over the top? Are the voting results defined by gender, age, economics, the war, or security, real experience, or race? It varies dramatically from state to state and from one news moment to the next. We can be for or against either candidate, it seems. Many people say they have waited till they go into the voting booth to decide. Pennsylvania is the big primary enchilada coming up on April 22nd. But those who are doing the math say that even after the last primary in Puerto Rico, there still may not be a nominee. That it's going to be too close to call right up to the convention. So what will that mean? And what about the superdelegate issue? How will Florida and Michigan be handled? Will they have to mount primaries sanctioned by the officials of the Democratic Party? I mean, these are the questions swirling around the studio today. Mm-hmm. But let's just start off generally. And I want to ask each of you how you are viewing this primary race that's been so full from day to day of who's up, who's down, and who's not?
On the whole, I have viewed it as a very positive thing.
Yes.
That we have come this far. Two-thirds of the states have voted. 27 million people have cast their ballots. And the rest of the folks who still have yet to vote, their votes still count. I think that's a very positive thing. And I think that the debates that we've had among the Democratic candidates have done a very nice job of advancing the ideas that will really move the country in a positive direction. So I think all of that has been to the good. I do have some concerns about where we are today, but I'll let Kate jump in with her overall perspective before I dig down into the nitty-gritty.
Okay. So what have you got to say, Kate?
Some of the things that I see there are really positive. The number of young people who are getting involved now, they're tremendously excited, particularly by Barack Obama's candidacy. So you have college students turning out and working for him, and what we're referring to, Obama maniacs.
Yes,
they may, in fact, continue to be part of the political process after this whole election season is over because they'll be fired up and want to do it. We're also seeing unusually high numbers of Latinos voting now. And I know predominantly they have been tending to be more Clinton supporters, but they're getting excited. And you're also seeing, and I think this was because of John Edwards, a growing awareness and willingness to talk about the wealth disparities
in this
country. And Edwards was really a very upfront about his tremendous concern and his willingness to be very outspoken.
I met him
that.
Several times, and I felt he had such a fire in his belly about this issue. And it wasn't something he dreamed up for the campaign. It's something very close to his heart. And I think that the candidate that goes for the main job is going to have to pay attention to the Edwards platform. I really do.
I really hope that is going to be carried forward now. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if you want to get into a little nitty-gritty, Barry, where would you go?
Well, I think we saw Obama make some of the first mistakes that he's made in several weeks in the last week leading up to the primaries in Texas, Ohio, Vermont, and Rhode Island. First of all, one thing that he did that I think was not to his benefit was he didn't really play the expectations game very well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the truth of the matter is Clinton had 20-point leads in Texas and Ohio, and he was able to cut massively into those leads in both states. Now, he didn't end up winning, but he narrowed the gap significantly. And he could have better framed the expectations around his performance such that Clinton would have had a harder time to claim these as decisive victories.
Indeed.
But he didn't do that, and I think that was a lost opportunity for him.
Yes, and particularly because she didn't pick up more delegates during this big hoo-ha over Ohio and Texas. He should have been smiling during the speech that he gave that night, and he wasn't smiling. And what does that communicate to us from someone who really is smiling a lot when he's campaigning? And in fact, when she was defeated on Super Tuesday, she smiled as if she had won. And so we get messages from these expressions that we see and how their voices sound and all the other body language that comes across. I think he came across in the last days as if he was tired and not fired as much as he was earlier on. And I'm sure he'll get it back, but that's what was true in these last weeks.
I think that's right, and I think that it goes to another thing that many people at this point have commented on, which is that, you know, in order to win these contests, and I think it's something that we'll continue to see, Hillary went negative.
Yes, she did.
In a very strong way, questioned his readiness to be commander in chief, and really stayed very strong on message about the economic issue in Ohio, and ironically, was speaking in very strong terms about NAFTA and the free trade agreements.
Mm-hmm.
Ironic, since she and Senator Obama both supported the free trade agreement for Peru that just came through the Senate this last session. So she did a very good job of attacking, and the campaign had stayed largely clear of that up until now, and he did not do a very good job of mobilizing and speaking out against those attacks.
I think one of the sad things is, in a way, it's almost the only viable strategy for Hillary Clinton now to be negative, because she's behind in terms of delegate points.
Quickly, what do you think some of the issues that Bush has suppressed that need to come back to the front, for instance, like science, though he's really taken us out of the picture in the scientific field?
Well, it's interesting because there is something called Science Debate 2008, where a large group of scientists are wanting to have a debate between the three presidential candidates, you know, McCain, Obama, and Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
In Philadelphia, right before that next primary coming up.
No kidding.
And it's precisely because there has been so much elimination of talent in the scientific area. It also happens to be elimination of talent in terms of administration and the regulatory structure of agencies throughout the administration under this Bush administration. So there is a lot of repair work that needs to be done in virtually every department there.
Sure.
Other things where I see problems, I think we've had a loss of international respect and influence. We have had an unconscionable delay in dealing with problems having to do with climate change and global warming.
Right.
And we're running in with a significant national debt. which was not there at the beginning of the Bush administration. And this is quite apart from what people's feelings are about the Iraq war in terms of whether the U.S. has a legitimate reason to be over there in the Middle East at all. It's still costing us a heck of a lot.
Oh, it's overwhelming, frankly. It's just overwhelming. And we have to really ask also the audience and all of us here at the table, will we be supporting either person when they become the nominee in order to have a Democrat in the job of commander-in-chief?
Well, this is one of the biggest concerns that I have at this juncture is that the exit polls on Super Duper Tuesday showed that a vast majority of Democrats, like 75%, would be happy with either major Democratic candidate winning the nomination and would come behind them to support them. However, today, as we see these campaigns go on a more negative direction, begin attacking one another in a more strident fashion, grudges are forming. And the longer this goes on, the more difficult it's going to be for the losing side to swallow their pride, to swallow those grudges, and come behind whoever has become the winning candidate. Even to the point where, unfortunately, I have seen rabble on the internet now talking about the convention in Denver, the threat of riots, the threat of
well, like 68, they don't want the 68 in Chicago.
A reprise of 68 from the losing side, if they feel like the other side has attempted to steal the nomination.
Well, with the superdelegates or anything else that goes on like that. So, I mean, it's a really tough call, and unfortunately, we have to go to break. So, I'd like to cite Anna Quinlan in the Newsweek article that I recently read to call out what's happening in politics today, because we have so many labels going on, liberal or conservative, Democrat or Republican. And she says those labels really don't apply. We'll talk about that and who's really shaping the future and the strategy for the Democratic Party next. So do stay tuned.
The Joan Kenley Show, talk radio your way on 960 KKGN. Dr. Joan Kenley, taking talk radio to the next level on Green 960 AM, KKGN.
Welcome back to the Joan Kenley Show. I'm Joan Kenley, and we're having a great conversation about election fever. My guests are Kate Forrest, President, and Barry Kendall, Executive Director of the Commonweal Institute, an action-oriented advocacy think tank committed to moderate and progressive individuals and organizations. I want to pick up a bit more of what Anna Quinlan was saying in Newsweek recently. She noted that if the body politic always winds up eventually tacking toward the center, it's difficult to imagine how progressive measures ever take hold. The reason is simple and cyclical. The center slowly shifts. Aha. So it's now a moderate position to believe in the full participation of women. 30 years ago, it was a radical position. And 50 years ago, it was barely a position at all. Well, too true. So we could say in some ways we've come a long way, but in others not. And I would like to bring Rob Stein into the conversation. He was here in the Bay Area for a progressive roundtable that Kate and Barry can tell us about. And we'll also be covering some of the other strategies that might help the Democrats win in November as we go along. So let's start with Rob Stein and his famous PowerPoint presentation that he's given around the country. So where is he with it now?
Sure. Well, Rob was an official in the Clinton White House. And in the early years of this decade, he did research on how the right wing did what it did.
For many years,
since the 70s, did exactly what Anna Quinlan described in that quote that you gave us, moved the center.
Mm-hmm.
And what the conservatives did is they moved the center of political discourse and what was politically possible in this country, they moved it to the right.
They did.
And how they did that was it began with funders who had a singularly clear purpose, which was to support a pro-business, pro-corporate agenda and to build a mass movement and a party structure that would support that agenda. And so they invested large amounts of money in think tanks to develop conservative policies and then promote those policies to the American people. And the vehicles for promoting those policies were conservative media outlets, and they invested heavily in those as well. They invested in developing spokespeople to go on those media outlets and talk about their ideas and developing them as leaders to take positions of leadership on school boards, city councils, state assemblies, and of course, Congress and the White House.
You bet.
Well, and going along with that, they also trained generation after generation of young conservatives to take offices in government.
Indeed,
and they get their internships there. They trained people to become government workers and leaders within government agencies, and they're throughout the administration now.
In From top
DC
to bottom.
And in the states, yes,
sure.
Both. And also they were looking for young talent, and so they'd look for people who had sort of an edgy kind of voice in speaking out on conservative things, and they'd bring them in and support them and give them all sorts of training and job opportunities, and really had a farm team that they were developing.
So Rob put together a presentation that described how conservative funders built this message machine, and he took it to wealthy, progressive and Democratic donors in New York, and in Los Angeles, and in San Francisco, and around the country, and showed it to them and said, look, this is how the conservatives did it. If we want to be as forceful in advocating for our ideas as they are, we're going to have to invest in developing those ideas and finding the best ways of communicating those ideas to the general public. And so Rob was a founder of a group of donors that were inspired by his message called the Democracy Alliance.
Right.
And Democracy Alliance began funding infrastructure organizations for a new progressive movement, organizations that would be dedicated to developing new ideas for a progressive direction for our country, and then promoting those ideas in the progressive media and then in traditional media outlets as well.
Well, I heard him give this presentation a few years ago, and I knew that those people who were coming into his think tank had to pay an extraordinary amount of money to be part of that group. And I was curious to know, since you've seen him more recently than I have, what actually has moved him from where he was a few years ago in terms of making something happen?
I rather suspect that he knew from the outset, as he was doing this research, he must have known that he wanted something to happen. And he recognized that he would have to bring the major funders on board to begin to have them put money into a progressive movement rather than doing what had been pretty much their exclusive pattern, which was either giving to candidates and campaigns mm-hmm. or giving to single issue organizations. Because building a movement which includes multiple different issues and many different candidates all across the country, it's and is not just limited to an election cycle, that's a very different funding pattern. And so he knew that they had to have that kind of education beforehand.
I recognize that, but what I'm saying is, did he report to the roundtable that you were experiencing with him recently what steps had actually happened since the inception of the idea? Did he actually say, well, we've come up with these programs, or we are actually moving this kind of idea out, or we've got a grassroots movement happening over here? Has he actually implemented any of those things yet?
Absolutely. The Democracy Alliance, this donor fund that he was instrumental in founding, has begun investing in think tank organizations who are developing new ideas about participatory democracy and advancing an idea for the positive role of government in solving the problems of society, which is something that the conservatives have hit very hard on over many years. He talked a lot about their investments in leadership development. But what he says, which I always find very interesting, is he says very pointedly, money is not our problem. Because the truth of the matter is that a lot of money gets invested on the on what we would call a progressive side of the equation. But it gets invested in single-issue organizations, mm-hmm. what we call issue silos, that have not yet learned how to coordinate with one another.
Exactly.
And one of the purposes of the Commonweal Institute's Progressive Roundtable program is bringing the diverse factions of the progressive movement together. So folks from civil rights, folks from peace, social justice, environmental groups, groups that are working on behalf of healthcare as an issue, gay and lesbian rights, media outlets, training organizations, labor unions. We bring all of these organizations together and begin to connect them with one another and help them understand that they have common cause, that there is a common sense of identity, and that together we do form a movement that can help take the country in a better direction if we will work in a coordinated fashion.
Yeah, the first progressive roundtable we had back in 2006 brought together progressive leaders from around the country who worked in the areas of idea development, marketing, political strategy, and communications to talk about what are the priorities if we're going to work together and how are we going to do this. And a number of the proposals that resulted from that gathering are things that are in operation right now. For example, in Colorado, a man named Mike Huttner started a very interesting thing called Progress Now that brings different groups together and gets the message out to the public right away about what's going on here. And this model has been replicated in multiple other states under other names now. So it's spreading throughout the country. And I'm sure Democracy Alliance was part of funding that. They don't tell publicly where they're putting their money, but I'm pretty sure that someone in there.
But we're happy to know that it's becoming viral and it's spreading around and that people are getting the idea here. For instance, near us, we have the Rock Ridge Institute. We also have MoveOn.org over in Berkeley, and they're across the country doing what they're doing about the election. And George Lakoff is doing his work in the world, Van Jones blogs. And in fact, you said when we were getting ready for this show that you'd like to bring up the subject of blogs.
Oh, a lot of people are very interested in blogs. Quite a few people are a little intimidated by blogs.
Right.
They've heard about Daily Kos and Talking Points Memo and the Huffington Post, and they might even go on and read these blogs. Blogs are an exciting form of new media that have become a really important part of building a progressive community. By helping people who may feel isolated, I live in a red state, for example, someone might say. I don't really feel like I have a progressive community around me, but I can go on to a blog like Daily Kos and find other people who think like I do,
mm-hmm.
and learn what's happening in the progressive movement, learn about the exciting new ideas about how to talk about healthcare, for example, that someone like George Lakoff and the Rock Ridge Institute have been working on. Here are new ways of thinking about and talking about these issues in your everyday life. But a lot of people have discovered, though, that one of the consequences of blogs being attracting like-minded people is that it can end up being a bit of an echo chamber.
There you go.
And the conversation can get overheated. There's something about the combination of the anonymity and the immediacy of a blog that I think brings out the most emotional communication styles.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's because also, people are talking about things that really matter to them.
Of course they are.
So the idea that you have people on these blogs who are getting angry and upset about what they see happening with conservatives in our government, for example, getting upset about what's happening with the war in Iraq and the mismanagement of that, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It is a mark that people really care and are looking for an outlet. My advice to people when I talk to them about blogs is, if you haven't yet, go check out some of the most popular blogs and just read them. And if you're a reader of blogs, though, there's a real opportunity here to join the community and become a commenter.
And find the one that you like, because there's many to choose from. If you find one is too heated and one is too mild, you can find something in the middle. But when we're also looking at what you decide to write in a blog or the kind of blog you like to read, I'd like to bring up that words are important. Mm. And I'm so tired of hearing on the campaign trail words like, this is going to be do or die. We're going to beat this person, slaughter that person, trounce this primary. I mean, it's just so sports and war oriented that I would rather see someone say, we have a better idea here. We're going to show you point A, point B, point C, and it's going to change your life. You know, so I would just like to put that out on the airwaves as we get ready to come up with our next segment.
Oh, well, I think this actually is one way in which by participating in the new media, you can have an influence on that kind of rhetoric in the traditional media. Newspapers and television news are trying as fast as they can to catch up with this new media technology on the internet. And every political reporter in a newspaper has their own blog. And that is a way that you can actually build a relationship with that reporter and say, you know, I really don't like the way that this is being covered. Can you shift the rhetoric to something that's less confrontational, to something that really gets away from the idea that politics is another form of entertainment.
Right, right. Great way to frame it, Barry. Great way to frame it. So we're going to ask the audience now, so what inspires you? What gives you hope for change that will truly work? Are you a liberal, progressive, conservative, or something else altogether? Where can you get involved? As a seasoned activist or a newcomer, Kate and Barry will tell you much more about the Commonweal Institute with many ideas and suggestions you won't want to miss about involvement. We'll be right back.
Ready for more? Dr. Joan Kenley continues in a moment on Green 960 KKGN. Log on to joankenley.com, that's K-E-N-L-E-Y, to learn more and listen to archived shows. Invite your friends and family to listen to The Joan Kenley Show online or on 960 KKGN every Saturday at 5.
I'm Joan Kenley, and you're back with The Joan Kenley Show. We're talking today about election fever. And with every election, words and labels are thrown around like confetti. And why has the label of liberal become so tarnished? The literal meaning of liberal means favoring proposals for reform. Not a bad idea. Being open to new ideas for progress. I like that. And tolerant of the ideas and behavior of others, being broad-minded. Well, how positive can you get? So, when did liberal become a dirty word? Well, let's look back a bit. Years ago, Franklin Roosevelt said, "A radical is a man with both feet firmly planted in the air." Right? "A conservative is a man with two perfectly good legs who, however, has never learned to walk forward." Oh, dear. Well, those are certainly interesting descriptions to ponder, wouldn't you say? Well, it's certainly clear that labels take on various meanings as the years go by. 75 years ago, FDR began using the word liberal in a way that could be interchangeable with progressive. At the time, the use of liberal was even viewed more positively than the term progressive. And indeed, liberals stayed in favor for the next 40 years. However, in the last 10 years, progressive has become the label with more cachet. Our guests, Barry Kendall and Kate Forrest, will describe their work at the Commonweal Institute as they guide and sustain the progressive movement. So talk to me more about how you're doing that with your core principles and with other things you're doing.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, Kate described that original trip to D.C., when not much was happening and there really wasn't much of a progressive movement to talk about at that time, and founded the Commonweal Institute to try to change that and to try to develop the progressive movement. And so the beginnings of that were calling for the need for a progressive movement and pointing out exactly how the conservatives have done that. In the last 6 years, 7 years, I'm happy to say that in part because of their call and many other people recognizing the need for this, a progressive movement has emerged, and many more organizations, like we talked about previously, have come into being to try to provide the substance for a movement that can be a political force in this country and move the conversation and move our policy back in a progressive direction.
Actually going forward.
That's right.
That making some progress,
yes,
for a change.
That's right. And so now, As the movement evolves, so Commonweal Institute's mission has evolved. But some things have remained constant, including our core principles, which we've been committed to since the outset. The first one is a commitment to future generations. And I really like this because it provides a really solid way of talking about one of the main things that liberals have been smeared on, and this is tax and spend.
Tax and spend,
the idea that taxes are a burden that we need relief from. This entire way of framing that issue is conservative to its core.
Isn't it, though?
So instead, I like to talk about how my parents and my grandparents and even my great-grandparents made investments in this country, made investments in our roads and in our bridges and in our economy.
And education.
And in our education, right? Invested in the very schools that I came through and was educated in. And that was their commitment to me. Mm-hmm. That was their commitment to my ability to chase the American dream, my chance to have an equal opportunity to chase that dream. And that's what taxes are. Taxes are our common commitment to one another and to our children and to our grandchildren, so that in 30 years or 50 years, hopefully we won't have bridges that are collapsing in Minneapolis the way they were last year.
Tragic, yes.
That's what a commitment to future generations is really about.
Well articulated. And how about environmental protection?
The environment is what we all live in. I mean,
of
obligatorily,
course.
We're all environmentalists in the sense that we're all in it and it affects every one of us. The necessities of life, whether it's water or air or the climate we're finding now.
Exactly.
And the idea is that for all of us, because we're all on this planet together and we don't have another one, is that the space that we live in, the environment that we live in, is something that we ought to be protecting for ourselves and also, again, for future generations. And if you think about the degree to which business has, and it's not just business, even governments too, have taken things from the environment and they use it as a place to dump things that they don't want, but they're not keeping it, they're not maintaining it, they're not restoring.
No. There's no balance there.
Right.
There's no reciprocity.
Right. The idea is to have a balance and to maintain a system that will continue to work for everybody.
Indeed. I think some of the most exciting things that are happening are businesses that operate on a premise of regenerative economics.
Absolutely.
Companies like Seventh Generation, which not only are doing our having a good business and making money, but they are also actually contributing more back to the environment than they take away. That's what a progressive economic outlook is for the country.
And what are you talking about in your principles when you mention inclusiveness and fairness?
Well, I think it's a fundamental meaning of progressive that has perdured throughout history has been progressive has been on the side of bringing more people into the process. Mm-hmm. It was a progressive movement that ended slavery in this country. It was a progressive movement that won the right of women to vote. It was a progressive movement that was the civil rights movement in the 1960s. We believe that, you know, there are sort of two poles here. There's representative democracy and there's participatory democracy. And as progressives, we really believe that our democracy will be better the more we have an educated citizenry that is actively participating in our democracy. And so we advocate for election reform to ensure that everyone has access and has free and fair elections that they're voting in. We advocate for campaign finance reform so that everyone has a voice in our elections. And then finally, we advocate for media reform so that we don't have a few large corporations monopolizing the conversation.
And certainly that is true right now. And also in terms of voting fairness, a big problem in our country, can we really have a fair election, is on everybody's minds. I mean, in Ohio, when they went from the electronic voting machines recently to paper ballots, they didn't have enough paper ballots for the people who wanted to vote. So in one county, they still closed the polls on time. And another one, they left it open for a while. But this shouldn't be happening. They know that many, many people are going to vote. And so I'm from the state of Ohio, but I have been embarrassed by Ohio election after election. So don't say, as so goes Ohio, so goes the nation these days, as far as I'm concerned. So I'd love to know more details about how our audience could benefit more from the Commonweal Institute, going to your website, which of course is commonwealinstitute.org, and wheel is W-E-A-L, Commonweal. But just let's get into the conversation about how your programs and what you propose to people to do to get more actively involved in how the country actually is going to go in the next generation and for the now.
Some of the things that I like to remind people is getting involved is not limited to the political season, to the campaign season.
Right.
You can be doing things to be actively involved all the time, 365 days a year. One of the things that's really good to remember is that the biggest influence you have over what goes on is through social networks. Those are the communications that people get from other folks that they interact with an occasional or daily basis are the things that are most likely eventually to get them to vote and to determine how they'll vote. And so you can be influencing that every day. One of the things, for example, that I kind of like to do is just take advantage of the time spent standing in the checkout line in the store. I'll say, looking at the prices on packaging or something and say, look at that. Gee, the price has gone up on this. I wonder if this has anything to do with the oil prices and the war in Iraq.
Great example.
One of the things I think is that liberals often get knocked on is the laundry list of policy issues, the laundry list of issues. And one thing that every person out there can do is start learning how to talk about what you believe in terms of your values.
And that means practicing in front of the mirror or with friends, because it doesn't just pop out of your mouth just because you're thinking to speak differently.
That's right. That's exactly right. So lead with, you know, I really believe in the value of freedom. Freedom is a really important thing to me. And the freedom to make choices about my body and how I'm going to lead my life and who I'm going to love, you know, but have the discipline and take the time to learn how to speak about what's really important to you in terms of your values, and lead from there then into talking about whatever the issue is that might be under discussion. That's a really important thing. And if more progressives and independent thinking people can start to learn that habit, our political discourse in this country will be much better off.
Agreed. And we have just a couple more minutes. So if you would tell our audience what maybe two or three things you think still could pull them in to being more active, what would you say?
Well, for one thing, you can go on Commonweal Institute's website, and there's a section on Get Involved, and you can go in there and there are specific suggestions of things that you can do to get involved.
That's right. Petitions that you can sign, issues that you can write your congressional representative or your senator or your state assembly representative about, all of those kinds of recommendations. Another thing that you can find on our website are recommendations for exactly how do I talk about values?
Mm-hmm.
How do I talk politics with people unlike myself?
Exactly.
That's another great way that you can do it. And if you really are involved, look up our Progressive Roundtable program, which has its own website at progressiveroundtable.org. That's a regular series of meetings with progressive organizations and activists from around the Bay Area. You can join us in those conversations and hear about what's happening in the movement right now and how you and your organization and your friends and colleagues can get involved.
Thank you, Kate, and thank you, Barry, for being so inspiring for us. Patrick Leahy said, if you get 15 Democrats in a room, you're going to get 20 opinions. Well, what's wrong with that, I might say? The more the merrier, till you can come to a strong collective agreement, which we hope will come to pass with this political party this year. And in closing, I'd like to say to everyone tuned in, thanks so much for listening. We want you to know that The Joan Kenley Show brings you conversation radio that's co-created for your listening pleasure with our guests. You can find out more about today's subject and how to reach our guests on my website, joankenley.com. That's K-E-N-L-E-Y, where all our shows are archived downloadable, and podcastable on demand 24/7. We're also on iTunes. Thanks go to those who made this show possible, Peter B. Collins and Christy Healy, and here in the studio, Daniel Fletcher, engineer and technical producer. This is Joan Kenley inviting you to tune into our show for more Conversation Radio every Saturday at 5 on Green 960 and green960.com.